thanks for coming along tonight. We're Catherine Murphy makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the publication of her essay on disruption, which has recently been released by Melbourne University Publishing. She's well known to all of you, I'm sure, so I'll introduce her very briefly. Catherine Murphy's been a journalist in the Canberra Parliamentary Press Gallery for 2 decades and is now the political editor of The Guardian Australia. She is the host of the political podcast Australian Politics Live and a regular pundit on television and on radio, including the ABC TV Insiders program, where we're going to catch up again on Sunday, I'm pleased to say. And she regularly contributes to Meanjin magazine, and tonight here talking on the topic of On Disruption, a report from the Australian Coalface. Catherine Murphy, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Just take a moment to set up. Well, thank you very much to Jared. It's a huge honour for me to address this institution, the Sydney Institute, the home of so many really important contributions to Australia's national life over such a long period of time. So I'm absolutely delighted to be here, and thank you for inviting me, Jared. Jared very kindly asked me to come along this evening to talk about my new little book, as he's foreshadowed, which is called On Disruption, which is an essay about the technological revolution that has upended the media, really, over the last decade, and the implications of that unmooring for us as a society. In beginning to address my topic this evening, I would be very remiss if I didn't acknowledge first Jared's forensic media watching over many, many, many years, and also recognise his status as chief media provocateur. Perhaps I might just begin at the beginning and share the origins of this particular project. As Jared mentioned in his very kind introduction, I contribute essays on a quarterly basis to the literary journal Meanjin. Last year, I wrote a piece about the punishing workplace environment of contemporary politics. I'd been looking for a way to get underneath the story of why politics just doesn't seem to be functioning as well as it used to, rather than just constantly bleating on about things being bad in some abstract sense. My husband actually suggested to me that I conceive of this essay as a series of exit interviews. He thought I should find some people who are no longer serving in the parliament, people I trusted, people who I felt were honest brokers and would talk to me truthfully about the life, people who aren't, you know, out on television settling scores every day of the week. Don't need to say any more, do I? And really get them to narrate the story of their daily existence. So I persuaded Greg Combe, a former Labor cabinet minister, a fellow by the name of Mel Washer, who's a very long-serving Liberal backbencher and, in my mind, very helpfully a medical practitioner. I also spoke to a fellow by the name of Matt Jose, who is a long-term political staffer who you never will have seen of or heard of, but quite a senior fellow who worked for both Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard right at the time where public life kind of went into hyperthrust. So I thought he would have some really good observations. Now, none of them were that thrilled about talking to me. Reflecting on the life, politicians reflecting on the life of politics is not really done. They don't really do it. That kind of introspection really isn't rewarded in the life. In fact, it's actively discouraged. But they did talk, and the life they recounted, for me at least, made sense of the external manifestations of dysfunction that we all see. So that harried sense of short-termism, the hyper-polarisation, and the rise of what I like to call combat for its own sake. They also reflected in their conversations with me on the lingering after-effects of the coup culture in politics. and the breakdown of trust, basically, within the coalition party rooms and the Labor caucus. As I gathered the material and thought about how I might structure it, the essay in my head became something of a tragedy in three acts. This essay wondered out loud whether the daily environment was now so punishing that politics had actually become hostile territory for human beings. Now, I don't want to linger here excessively, except to say that the first essay, when it was published, triggered a really amazing reaction inside politics and from the general public. I'm quite prolific. I publish a lot and across a lot of different platforms, but I can honestly tell you that I've never had a reaction to anything that I've ever written quite like it. People rang. They wrote to me from all around the country. Politicians I knew very well. Some politicians I'd never in fact spoken to. Some people from the state parliaments all of a sudden rang and wanted to have a yak about it. People seemed relieved that somebody was actually documenting the life in a way that wasn't judgmental or vituperative, that the object of the exercise was documentary. I wanted to try and capture the life as best I could. So people inside my world, the world of the 2600 postcode in the National Parliament and the National Capital, they still bail me up to talk about this piece a year after it was written. So this isn't some great humble brag. It's me telling you that some kind of taboo got lifted, strangely. So my conclusion from all of that, was that lifting up the hood of this particular car and looking in the engine was absolutely worth doing. I resolved at that point really to stop judging and start reporting. It's an old-fashioned concept, I know. Anyway, so part of the story I recounted in that essay, The Political Life is No Life at All, I might send that to you, Jared, in the event that you want to share, was the impact of us. And when I say us, I mean the journalists who inhabit the same ecosystem as the parliamentarians. I thought at first I might cover us all in one piece, just cover it all off. But as the piece took shape, I decided I needed to actually lift us up and out so that I could think about us more carefully and more deliberatively, and also because the piece, frankly, would have been so unwieldy that poor old me engine couldn't have published it. So I paused there until Louise Adler and Sally Heath, the publishers from MUP, offered me a berth in their fabulous little On series, which is where my book appears. These are short books on particular topics of the author's choosing. And so that invitation became an opportunity for me to square this circle, to bring the whole story together in some shape or form. So last summer, I shut myself away in my little office at home and I engaged in some sort of psychic time travel. I wanted to walk myself back in my own mind to 1996, when I waited at the Senate side of Parliament House to be signed in by my colleagues at the Australian Financial Review. That was 2 weeks before Paul Keating called the election that he would ultimately lose to John Howard. I had to recreate the world of print journalism in the decade before the digital disruption showed up in order to really understand what we did then and what we do now and whether the differences between what we did then and what we do now are material and whether they contribute to this story in some shape or form. So On Disruption starts there, literally, in the summer of 1996 in the AFR Bureau in that last decade of the print-only era. It recounts a pretty orderly world where sharing information, if you were a newspaper journalist, was rationed to once a day. It's kind of a startling thought to me that we ever did that, that we only spoke to our readers once a day, once every 24 hours. It seems impossible, actually, that that ever happened, but it really wasn't that long ago. Now, the life of the print journalist, basically, you gather your material all day, you push the various news stories forward, you seek out new information, you chase voices of agreement and voices of dissent. If you're a political journalist, you chase all of that stuff and then you gather it together and you file in a great rush at the end of the day. That's the print life. And then, obviously, what you file is collated into the newspaper, it's printed, it's trucked out all around the country and it thuds on people's lawns. the next morning. Now, obviously, I know this is still happening. This is still occurring. I'm just talking about an environment when that's all that print journalism was. So when you track back to those times and analyse the processes, what I could see reasonably clearly was that the old print cycle prioritised the important over the new. I'll just let you sort of settle on these thoughts as we go through. So news is important, obviously. It is the essence of news, after all. What is new is obviously the essence of news. But in the print era, something also had to be important in order to be recorded, reported 12 hours after it happened. It had to have a shelf life. It had to be something meaningful. Now, print prioritised the important by imposing a non-negotiable rationing system. Fixed deadlines, finite space, and an identifiable separation between news and commentary. Radio in those days, of course, filed on the hour, every half hour. They filed all the time, and TV, number of news bulletins over the course of the day. But us in print, once, every 24 hours. Then, about a decade into my tour of duty in Canberra, the internet arrived. And that upended all of our daily rituals. And the arrival of the internet heralded a new kind of currency in the news cycle. The currency of digital, particularly in the opening stages of the technological disruption, was the new. What happened now? And then what happened next? And what happened after that? Important took a step back. The requirement to keep on top of and share the endless iterations of the new actually made it harder for journalists to get to the important. You know, there's only so many hours in the day. There's only so much one person can do. There's only so many projects that one person can juggle at any given time. So the shift in emphasis I've just shared with you may seem a kind of trivial distinction, may seem sort of, well, so what, ho-hum. But if you let your mind settle there for a minute or two, it might help to explain at the simplest level what changed when the technology did. It might explain, again, if this thought takes root, why news content feels different than it felt 10 years ago. It might explain why it feels lighter somehow, more transient, like it's kind of whipping around in some ferocious headwind. So digital allowed us to bring you events as they happened. And that step change helped create a constituency, of course, for the rolling news channels. As news began to be delivered differently, something else happened. As well as everything speeding up, the media and the political ecosystem in Australia became shriller, it became shoutier, in journalism's case it became less specialised, and the whole environment, the whole ecosystem I inhabit became more polarised. Politics, which had sort of gone along at a, you know, reasonably competent clip, seemed to fall out of its stride. The conversation around politics also began to sound a lot like an echo chamber. Like-minded souls began clustering in small groups, reinforcing their various predispositions rather than engaging in what I would call a free-flowing debate. Articles of faith were given greater prominence than facts because we saw the rise of the opinion cycle and the shoutier the better. So we've undergone this technological-driven shapeshift. In my view also, the media has become more vulnerable to capture and more vulnerable to manipulation by crafty newsmakers. And I think we've seen that most palpably in the United States in the lead-up to the election of Donald Trump. Now, before I push on and get into some other concepts, I want to be very, very clear about one thing. On Disruption is not a memoir of a journalist who has made a transition. It's not a pity party for me or for my colleagues. It's not a sustained session of woe is me in the hope that someone will buy me a massage voucher or send me a bunch of flowers or say, there, there, poor dear. I also don't want this to be an in-house conversation. I don't want this to be a conversation that journalists stand about having with other journalists and don't share this with news consumers. I want to engage news consumers and get you all thinking about the sum of these parts and how the sum of these parts impacts the world you live in and the media you consume. So this is an effort by me to explain how change in my world impacts yours. It's an effort by me to explain how my disruption is actually yours. I don't want you to care about me. I want you to care about you and the society that you live in. That's the point of the essay. So it's hard for me to be precise about when our world changed. God knows it's very helpful when you write a book, if you can produce out of your back pocket some seminal moment where the world was one thing one second and then it was something else the next second. Sadly, this disruption didn't work that way. It came in little waves. Insofar as I can identify the time frame that we're talking about, basically we're talking about round about the time John Howard lost office and Kevin Rudd washed into Canberra. So it's round about that period. It's round about 2007, and it kind of came in waves really until I think the peak of it hit in 2012. That was kind of more or less where it was. So as I've explained to you, even instead of filing once in the evening as we had, all through Keating, all through Howard, all through that period, we began filing through the day and the night as the news broke, or preferably when we broke the news. So just, I suppose, I'd try a few different concepts to try and land these thoughts for people outside journalism. And I think maybe think about Uber. Just as Uber has now transformed what we think of a taxi, or what we think a taxi is, and Airbnb has transformed the idea of what people think a hotel is, the computer, the tablet, and the mobile phone gave journalists breaking news on the go. And that, again, sounds like an increment, but in our world, it's actually a revolution. It's actually us doing something quantifiably different than what we've done in the past. So audiences want their news right now. I imagine you're all very disciplined. None of you are looking at your phones, but I'm amazed none of you are, because the biggest story in the world at the moment are those kids in the Thai cave. Mm. And everybody is hanging on every increment of that story. Rightly so. It's an amazing story. You know, hopefully those... God, you don't even want to think about it, do you? But anyway, so I understand why audiences want their news now. I totally get it. I'm even to blame in the political sphere. I was the first person in political journalism to take out a daily live blog as a daily offering. Now, if you guys have never seen a live blog before, what it is basically rolling coverage of events as they happen. When I did the live blog, I filed every 10 minutes all day, from 8 o'clock in the morning till whenever the story ended, whether that was, you know, 5 p.m, 8 p.m, midnight, whenever it was. And that was even 100% my idea. And the thing about live is that you have to be attentive. Everybody has to be attentive in the system all the time. Even when you pull the plug and you go home to recharge, you can't entirely put it down. You've got to be connected. You've got to understand what's going on, because if something shifts materially, you've got to be back. You've got to be back calling the play. Now, the consequences of that shift for work intensification are pretty obvious, I would think. As we sped up, as we got faster, it also became abundantly clear that we would be speeding up and producing journalism with less people. The business model that sustained print journalism through its golden age, courtesy of this disruption, was now in serious strife. When the technological disruption hit, we gave our content away for free to audiences that we'd previously asked to pay for it. And all those classified ads that once bankrolled prosperous newspapers were also now migrating online to the burgeoning online digital economy. So then the redundancy round started. And they kept coming. 1,000 jobs in Australian journalism were lost in 2012 alone. people who were walking out the door were also highly experienced journalists. The longitudinal study that's looked at the redundees who have left journalism in this period has found basically that the average age of the departing cohort was 49, average of 2 decades worth of experience on the job. So just as we hit the white water, we lost our river guides. Now, the other thing about digital is it's given us analytics. That analytics allow us to understand our audiences like we have never understood them in the past. During the print era, we could only really guess why readers bought the paper. I mean, we would have done some market research, I guess. We would have thought, you know, did people like a particular columnist or a particular issue? Or we would have done market research. But now we know in quite minute detail what people read, how long they read it for, where they get it from, whether they share it, all of these things. There's also search engine optimization, a hitherto unknown specialty in my line of work that has arrived courtesy of the digital disruption. And search engine optimization is all about getting your content in front of as many eyeballs as possible. So we've had the rise of analytics. And analytics have had a really profound effect on the news business and also profound effects on the way journalists view their own work. All of a sudden, we've got a new performance measure. Very, 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 very tangible one. And that's a performance metric that can easily mess with your head if you let it. What else happened in this digital world? Well, the readers move closer, a lot closer. In the print era, readers were all around me, but they were quite distant. They were a long, long way away from me. Some got through on the phone periodically, would ring through to the Canberra Bureau and have a chat. Of course, they were on the letters page, as they still are in newspapers. But for a print journalist like me, it was very rare to be buttonholed in the street, be pulled up, be interrogated about something you'd written or thought or whatever else. If you weren't Paul Kelly or Michelle Grattan, you enjoyed a rumpled sort of anonymity. But the rise of social media transformed our proximity equation, and journalists entered a period of equality, really, with their audiences. So what I call the voice of God conceit, which is a hallmark of the print era, where all-knowing journalists graciously handed down their stone tablets of wisdom every day on the news pages and the opinion pages, imagining themselves the omniscient narrators of contemporary history, those folks began to be called out by people on social media, many of whom were micro-publishing on blogs or social media everywhere else. So when that disruption hit, emperors were replaced by the variety devoid of clothes. This environment felt very saturated. It felt very cacophonous, and it felt highly uncertain. The online behemoths, Facebook, Google, Apple, they first took the advertising that once sustained our journalism, and then some of them began distributing our content too. Our content from mainstream media organisations, and other content that looked for all the world like ours, exactly the same, through their channels. So these companies became publishers, but they didn't want actually any of the responsibility of being a publisher, which means checking, vetting, verifying information flowing through your channels. So material was shared across the web without any due diligence being applied. So progressively it became hard for news consumers to pick what was real and what was fake. Am I depressing you all too much, yeah? Recently, my eldest son was home from Seattle, where he works currently in the tech industry, and he told me about some technology that allows video footage to be manipulated. So with new voiceovers, new lip syncs, moving in with total verisimilitude, all totally fake. Terrifying to me. Terrifying to anybody who considers facts their core business. So how does this all feel from the inside? Hence the coalface account. Well, I can tell you what it feels like. It feels deeply unsettling. Anybody inside my ecosystem who tells you that they've felt no anxiety at all during this transition is either cracking hardy or kidding themselves. At a more practical level, what journalists have had to do over the last 10 years is relearn our trade in front of a live audience. Without any time to reflect, to take ourselves off quietly, to just experiment amongst ourselves, to polish or practice or innovate in some little private space before bursting back and saying, "Hi, we've perfected it." We had to do it in front of you. I share a little analogy in the book about imagine yourself as a car maker, because when I talk about this with audiences, I find for some reason that one cuts through, whereas some other comparisons don't. So just imagine yourself a car maker at this point. You've worked on the factory floor for years and years and years. You wander out of your factory one night. When you come back the next morning, all the machines are different. The entire factory floor has been revolutionised. Your workflow is disrupted. There are massively increased expectations about your productivity. You find that basically half the cohort of staff are now not there. And you are working for a management with an incredibly detailed understanding about what the consumer wants and when they want it. And then, to cap it all off, there's a consumer at the end of the line who isn't prepared to pay for what you do because in the first iteration you gave it away for free, and as the technological disruption gathered pace, consumers became suspicious about whether or not your car was real or fake, which also discounts its currency. And all of this is playing out in front of a live audience invited into the factory with loud hailers, and all those people are telling you 24/7 how you could do that so much more efficiently. That's basically what I've lived through. So what could possibly go wrong? Well, let's be honest, things have gone wrong. The digital revolution has refashioned our public life, our politics, the media, and now we all dance to this same thready beat. In writing this little book, I wanted to ask myself the most challenging question I could possibly think of to ask myself about the current state of play. And it took me a little while to settle on what that question might be, but I got there in the end, and the question was, are we, the disrupted media, making things worse? Now, posing this question puts me on a collision course with journalism's foundational myth. Journalists think of ourselves as value adders, as the speakers of truth to power. Institutionally, we absolutely believe what we do is valuable. And sometimes, even demonstrably, it is. Corruption gets exposed, wrongdoing, all of that stuff. But we also, I think, have to own the possibility that we are making things worse. Not because we want to, not because we all woke up one day and decided that we would all be crap, but as a consequence of this transition that we are currently living through. I think we have to be, as a profession, sufficiently self-aware to step inside that possibility and to own that possibility if we are to have any hope of living up to our best professional ideals. So it's possible that after a decade of constant change, the media as a collective is hollowed out, hyperextended, and a bit untethered. It's also possible that we are burning both ourselves and our audiences out in the relentless chase for the new, which is it's like a minute-by-minute crusade that ultimately generates more heat than light and sometimes plunges civic conversation into a state of chaos and, at its worst, borderline unhinging. Just in case you're interested, I hit that particular nadir on page 65, right in the middle of trying to assess whether journalists created the conditions that got Donald Trump elected. Please be aware that this is a little book that does not spare us. The times really are too serious, and we need to face up to the truth. The other zone I explore is conflict and the commoditisation of conflict. Now, news has always been about conflict. My first bureau chief, lovely man, Tom Burton, told me very early in my apprenticeship at the Fin Review that it's not a news story if we don't hit conflict by the third paragraph. So the conflict prism is as old as journalism itself, and it's certainly a driving force in political journalism because political journalism is the battle of ideas. And we're right in the middle of it. But there's also a heightened dimension to the conflict, I think, in our disrupted ecosystem. We've got to think about the role of conflict in a democracy. The role of conflict in a democracy is to try and synthesise competing ideas without resort to violence. That's what it is. It's what it's meant to do. It's meant to be a pipeline to a settlement of some type. But increasingly, I think conflict is manifesting really as a commodity in and of itself. It's become a means of differentiating you from your opponent, if we're talking about politics. In news, it's a means of differentiating your product from your competitors. As people become less trusting of institutions, then institutional players like politicians and news outlets feel like they need to rally their tribes. So as a consequence, we see a lot of narrow casting happening in the public square. People talking to one another in their little bubbles rather than engaging with people with whom they disagree in an effort to find common ground. I think a lot of the conflict we see is manufactured, frankly, manufactured product differentiation rather than an actual battle of ideas. If I look at the political landscape and some of the media landscape that captures it, I see partisans locked in studious dialogue with other partisans. A little kabuki play for a boutique audience, with politicians egged on by shock jocks and bobbleheads in the media intent on their own narrowcasting exercise. Tribalism has become a commodity, both for establishment politicians who want to hold their core supporters and not see them drift to the outsiders and insurgents that now litter the landscape everywhere around the world post-GFC, and also for the media companies who want engaged and preferably paying audiences if we're all to survive the disruption that's playing out brutally still. So from my perch, frankly, it feels like we're all chasing one another through the same wormhole. So where do we go from here? Well, truth is, I don't know. And I don't think anyone does. Since the little book was written, the latest survey of digital trends by Reuters, Oxford and the University of Canberra, fortunately, hooray, this is where we get to the good bit, has provided some encouraging signals. Trust in media in Australia has improved in the last 12 months. And also there has been a noticeable increase in this market for people paying for their news. And those two things are bigger jumps than in any of the other 37 countries surveyed. I think as time passes too, we in the media are adjusting to the uncertainties in our new normal. I think we're doing better as a collective at trying to balance the new and the important. I think we're more aware of that trade-off now, particularly than we were at the beginning. If you guys are avid consumers of news websites, you may have noticed that they're less frenetic than they were even 12 months ago. You'll notice that the content is not quite as endlessly refreshing as even 12 months ago. I suspect this isn't an accident. Now, I've dwelled this evening on the downsides of digital disruption and our digital revolution, the adjustment costs, if you like, because I want to start a conversation and because I want to engage news consumers in their own ecosystem. But it's not all downside. What digital offers is a community of interest between journalists and readers, which I really enjoy, and I thrive in that environment. The flip side of the abuse that journalists now cop is the enrichment that's provided by experts who are now in constant communication with journalists, often in full public view, in front of you all. And digital makes us show our work. It makes us be transparent about how we arrive at particular conclusions and how we report them. I personally cop a lot of abuse, some of it really off. Women seem truly to get the bulk of the nasty stuff, but I get an enormous amount of encouragement too from readers and community, which I'm really profoundly grateful for. So what do I believe? I believe that truth-telling can make things better, even as the environment makes it harder to us for us all to establish what the truth actually is. I believe if you're given a platform, you should do your best to serve causes larger than yourself. I believe that the appropriate response to adversity is always bravery, innovation, and hard work. Life doesn't give any of us certainty. All it gives us is the opportunity to try and reach deeper understandings with people and try, in our own modest spheres, to make the world a better place. So my little book ends this way. I don't know if journalism will survive this great disruption. I don't know if I can sustain myself through this period of change, or whether I'll burn out or tossed out or get tossed out or go crazy. Every day I mourn our losses, my mentors who are living their lives beyond journalism, and I worry that we are the problem, not the solution. And I also wonder how on earth this period in history will ultimately be written. But rather than worrying ourselves to paralysis, my colleagues and I press on. We try and explain, we try and understand, we hope. We try to navigate these epic cross currents, and in the end, it doesn't matter if we can't know the future. As the great diarist Samuel Johnson said so long ago, it matters not how long a man dies, but how he lives. The act of dying is not of importance, it lasts such a short time. Thank you for listening.
So many thanks to Catherine Murphy for a stimulating discussion. As I said earlier, we've got some copies down the back there of On Disruption, which is the essay booklet, which has just come out and which our speaker addressed tonight. So, Catherine, if you come back here, we'll go to no later than the top of the hour. There are a lot of people here, so I ask you to keep your questions or comments brief. Obviously, I agree with your analysis essentially, but I'd just like you to reflect. Historically, you went to Canberra for the first time, Parliament House, in 1996. I went in 1976. In 1976, afternoon papers still existed. Mm. They were quite important. The Sun and the Mirror in Sydney, tabloids fighting one another, high level of conflict. The Herald in Melbourne, a much more reflective broadside, very influential evening paper. In our family, my father read it every night. Then you go back to the 30s, the advent of radio. That changed everything. Television, 1956 in Australia. But if you go back and reflect on the Kennedy-Nixon debate of the 1960 election, that was a huge change as well. And then your own essay, which starts off, really, as you said, in Jonathan Green's Meanjin Quarterly. Now, that's got a small distribution, but your essay had a huge impact in a magazine that starts off with a small distribution, a bit like the old pamphlets of 100 years ago. So have things changed as much, or are they changing? Have they changed as much, or is it much the same?
Uh-huh. I knew you would ask me that. I was trying to prep myself, actually, for what your first question would be, and I was sort of close, I think. You're right, Jared. It's sort of the more things change, the more things stay the same, obviously. I'm not trying to pretend or argue for one moment that my generation of journalists are the only journalists that have experienced some kind of major technological disruption. That would be obviously absurd, because this medium is highly dynamic and it has evolved at various stages in history. You're quite right to point out that there were previous afternoon newspapers, and in fact when the internet hit, a lot of the older journos said it's like being back in afternoon newspapers, right? I think while we have seen technological disruption in the past, which has changed the nature of journalism and certainly changed the means of public discourse. For example, well, television, I think, revolutionised politics, like in a massive way, revolutionised politics. But there are elements about the current disruption that I don't think are very well understood, and consequences associated with the current disruption that I don't think are routinely understood, largely because we don't talk about them. And that's not because we want to be secretive about it, but it's just that we're a bit like the politicians. We don't have a culture of self-reflection. We don't much. There's lots of really great stuff being done in academia about this disruption and the implications thereof, but as a profession, we don't talk about it that much. So, Jared, you're right. I'm not saying that our generation is the only disrupted generation. I'm saying that there are peculiarities about the current disruption that require scrutiny and self-awareness, both among practitioners and also amongst news consumers. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yes, it does. Yeah. So a question up the back.
Thank you, very interesting.
It's not on.
Yes. Right in. doesn't it,
Bob? Just go.
Come on.
I'm sure I'll be able to hear you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for an interesting commentary. You mentioned conflict and
the role. Thank you. The role to create conflict.
Yeah.
Do you think that journos were responsible for the changing of PMs with Rudd and Gillard, and then also the rolling of Abbott by Turnbull, and you're trying to foment another rolling?
Oh, God. I cannot tell you.
Is that a good thing for journalists to do?
I cannot tell you how much we're not trying to foment. honestly, I think, you know, I think there's a level of fatigue, frankly, with this. I think there is a level of profound fatigue, both in the public and amongst us. In terms of, okay, did we foment? No. I think the political parties did that all to themselves. But what happened with the step change was that the system was more easily gamed and manipulated. And because a lot of the leadership instability occurred coincidentally at the same time as this disruption, I think that certainly that new element of the transition that I've been talking about was kind of a perfect storm in a way. So did we foment it? I don't think so. We amplified it. We absolutely did. We amplified it. But I think that is materially different to fermenting it. And in terms of the attitude towards leadership, I know there is a very widespread view among news consumers that gallery journalists are obsessed with leadership challenges and that's what we live for. Oh, my God. Like, really, no. Really, no. Underlined.
John Hardy.
Catherine, one thing you haven't mentioned tonight is who is going to pay for this disrupted journalism in the future.
Mm, thank you for raising that.
We have the news aggregators, the citizen journalists online. 100 sources tonight, while I'm sitting here listening to you, will tell me about what's going on in the caves up there in Thailand, including video streaming if I wanted.
Yep.
But there's no model which is coming forward apart from suggestions of public interest journalism being funded by collectives and so on.
Yep.
And in your case, the Guardian Trust funds a lot of it. And some of us are quite willing to pay $100 to Gerard to stay here each year and $100 to the Guardian to get your stuff as well.
Yep.
What model are we going to see when the rivers of gold have gone?
Thank you very much for that question. And just in terms of The Guardian, just so that we're clear, the Scott Trust does not actually fund us in Australia. We are self-funded in this country, but the Scott Trust does fund The Guardian in the UK and in the US. In terms of what we're going to, what's happening, this is sort of the front line of the most interesting experiments that are occurring, I think, at the moment. We see across news organisations different models for trying to make journalism sustainable, because obviously the model of showing half your workforce the door, is fine insofar as it goes, but doesn't actually sustain civic life into the future. So in every media organisation, whether it's publicly funded or privately funded or some combo, this is where the action is, in terms of editorial grunt thinking, commercial grunt thinking. There are a lot of different models. Obviously, in newspapers, which is my field, obviously there are hard paywalls. Everybody will be familiar with a hard paywall. You know, the content is locked down. You pay a subscription. You don't see it if you don't pay. There are soft paywalls, some triggered by repeat visits. They've been successful for media properties like the Washington Post and the New York Times, but they are very, very rare media properties. Beyond that, at The Guardian, we're experimenting with a model called membership, that John referred to, which is people paying an annual fee for getting what we produce. The content is not locked down and members don't get anything particularly special, except you might get a nice email from me sometimes or from Lenore Taylor or a nice First Dog on the Moon cartoon or something. Thank you for helping us. So there's that model. Interestingly, John, I don't think in Australia yet, but certainly in the UK, membership is now a bigger revenue stream for The Guardian than advertising. So in a media property like The Guardian, with a very loyal audience, we fortunately people have been supporting our work. Also quite interesting to me, and I go into a little bit of audience in the book and the consequences of audience-funded journalism in the era we're currently living through. There are some very interesting experiments in Europe about crowdsourcing and crowdfunding of journalism projects. We've tried one in the Australian media market at The Guardian. We launched a program called Wide Brown Earth, and we went to market and basically told our audience that we felt that there were a bunch of environmental stories that just weren't being covered because we didn't have the resources to do them. How would you like to, you know, how would you like to help? And within 48 hours, we, I think, raised about $150,000 in order to fund that project. So in Europe, some of the news organisations in Europe are actively experimenting in this space with crowdsourcing of either individual projects or the operation more generally. The downsides of that are obviously you need to be careful about that frontier between journalism and activism and where you seek to draw those lines. But this is what's going to save us or not save us, and this is really the work of the next 10 years. And I can only say in this audience, as I do for every audience that I ever front, if you value journalism, if you believe that it is a civic good, pay for it. It doesn't happen any other way. It will not happen any other way. If you don't pay for it, we're done.
There's a question up
there. Catherine, I'm optimistic because I've got grandchildren. How much is this disruption notion really about our generation? Because every 50 or so years, or every 100 or so years, there's a big changeover of professions and trades and whatever. I mean, the men who drove lorries with horses and people picked up the dung and, you know, all the different things that we go through in our evolution. This is just another one of the changes. And this morning on the ABC Breakfast Show, there were a whole lot of little girls who were spending their holidays, they look like primary school kids, learning coding. Uh-huh. And the person who was putting it across as a story said, coding should be taught like a language, as if it was just a language you learn in primary school. So to what extent is it just our shivers? I don't have any great fear for journalism. I think journalists are going to have to be much more into TV medium, video medium. And you see this now on the Australian webpage. You've got the ordinary print journalists now doing face-to-camera commentary. And the younger ones will just pick up this new technology as if it was, you know, the milk on the doorstep. So, is it just us?
Thank you, Anne. Is it just us? Well, at some level, yeah. But I'm not a Luddite. I don't want to smash my computer, and I don't want to undo digital. Even though I'm not as, you know, I have concerns about it, because, you know, I did touch on some of the upsides as well as downside. It's certainly not all downside. I'm not so much railing against the technological step change as I am trying to encourage a degree of acuity about the implications of it. It's not that I want to go back to the Fin Review in 1996. I actually don't. I'm sort of so past, in my own practice, I'm sort of so past newspapers now I can't, you know, I'm sort of not that anymore. And I don't want to be that anymore. And I'm not raising these concerns to inflict my own values on the world. I'm trying to have this conversation again to make people think about why are things different? Am I, you know, because there's such a pull in the technology to herd people into camps, herd people into tribes. Everything from social media algorithms that show people content that they agree with, to this sort of dreadful kind of gated communities online with people not seeking to actually find common ground, but people speaking to, you know, attempting to speak over one another, polarisation for its own sake. It's sort of, that's a real slippery slope. And the thing that concerns me too about the environment most of all is that the constituency, what used to bind us all together was a sort of a shared set of facts, that we all kind of adhered to the same facts. That was kind of the bond. Everybody has different worldviews. I'm not suggesting that everyone should have the same worldview. It's much more interesting if everyone has a different worldview. But once we all agreed on the facts, now we don't even agree on the facts anymore. The facts are overlaid with people's, you know, near religious sort of predispositions about things. Then you're in serious slippery slope territory. Then you're in territory where governments can't do things because there's not an agreed constituency in order to affect reform and change. That's why I'm worried, not because I want to smash my computer.
Now, we've got about 10 minutes, so we've got to be brief. Stephen.
Thank you, Catherine. I want to ask you a bit more about the nexus between the journalist and journalism and democracy.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very strong argument that democracy flourishes when it's held accountable, and of course journalists have been the ones that have led that accountability.
Yep.
And I think we would all agree that the advertising model to support journalism is dead, and that's caused all of the things that you've talked about tonight. But you mentioned the sort of Trump issue, but if you think about, you know, some of the drivers, investigative journalism was one of the biggest, and of course it's the most expensive, it's done over a long time, you don't do it by racing out and posting a few stories. What's going to happen to investigative journalism, and what are the ramifications for democracy?
Well, one thing, thank you for that question, thank you for that. One thing that is not commonly understood, and this is sort of allows me to loop back to please pay for journalism, but there's method in my madness. What a lot of people don't understand about investigative journalism is that it requires media organisations off scale to be able to do it, not only because investigations are resource intensive, but because the targets of investigative journalism sue. They sue pretty much every time. And defending a defamation proceeding in this country is enormously expensive, hugely expensive, deep pockets. If organisations, if news organisations cannot function at scale, if they cannot defend their work against defamation proceedings, then we will not have investigative journalism. It won't happen. It just won't happen. So that's why this needs to be understood. Scale matters. Scale matters both to have bodies, sufficient bodies in your news organisation with the requisite skills and experience to be able to deliver investigations of high impact. And also organisations need to be able to defend them when they come under attack through the courts or elsewhere. So what's going to happen? A lot of organisations are, in a time of limited resources, understanding that that's very much a focal point of what we should be doing as a cadre, as a group of people. So and good investigative journalism is being done in this country, fortunately. You might be interested to see that some of it now is co-productions. Again, that's about sharing costs and risks, right, as the environment gets tougher. Obviously, larger organisations will do more investigations than smaller organisations, but even in my own, which is quite a small one, we've devoted a lot of resources to investigative reporting on conditions in Nauru and Manus, for example, which we think is very important and very much in the public interest, because what's occurring in those offshore camps is a long way away from us and people are not aware of what's going on. So look, everybody in the industry wants to continue doing it, but it is very important to understand the economics of it, which leads me back to please pay for journalism.
Your two final questions. There's one there, we'll end up with Mark. Got to be brief.
Thank you for your talk. Politicians are virtually some of the lifeblood of your careers. You have to maintain access with them. But it seems to be only journalists and only the newspapers can actually get the politicians. How can you improve their standards and their probity? Because nobody else can do it.
Just help me up there a little bit. So
what he's suggesting that the media should help improve the standards of politicians and politics.
So we need to go harder? Is that what you
much
mean?
Harder.
Yeah, right.
Within. Then you lose your access. Yeah.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, right. Sorry, silly lady tumbles in the end. I got there. Obviously, access versus punching with a closed fist is a calculation. But I think the longer you are around as a political journalist, the less preoccupied you become about that. I think it is quite important to you at an early stage in your career to have the sort of access you're talking about. You are preoccupied with it, because obviously political reporting, you need to understand your own environment in order to do anything meaningful. So access is not nothing, access is something, right? But I think the longer you do this, the less concerned you become about that. I mean, it's not a non-issue, but for, I mean, I don't care. I really don't. Do you think Laura Tingle cares?
No.
I'm pretty sure she doesn't. Do you think Michelle cares? No. I think the longer you do it, and that in and of itself is when people say to me, oh, God, why are those same turgid old people, including me, still in the parliamentary press gallery, still doing all that stuff? Well, that's an investment you make. That's an investment you make till you get to a point in your career where you really could not give a rat's what those people think. Really not. And you're in. I saw a lovely exchange about 12 months ago between Laura and the Treasurer, actually, at the National Press Club, where Scott Morrison didn't really like the question that she asked, and she responded to him by saying, "Well, Scott, I'll be here longer than you." All you need to know.
Final question, Mark.
Thanks. Congratulations. The disruption seems to have been least impacted in the publicly funded media organisation. You didn't make any observations about that on the way through.
Yeah.
Did you make one now?
I think they'd argue with you, Mark, that they haven't been impacted. I mean, obviously they've had pretty substantial budget cuts and... Please.
It depends on the measure over time.
Yeah.
They used to be and complained when they were $800 million a year.
Yeah.
Now they're in excess of $1 billion a year.
Yeah,
they say they've been cut.
Yeah.
Now, you're talking about the same period of time of disruption in relation to the privately funded media. So they've gone from $800 million in about 2007.
Yep.
To in excess of $1 billion now,
yep.
Whilst your organisations and all of the other organisations have seen their revenue streams shrink dramatically, and they do appear to have been less disrupted than their competitors in the private.
Probably in aggregate, that's true, that they are less disrupted because obviously, as you say, they have a secure funding source which the rest of us don't. So in aggregate, I hear what you're saying. You're right. But if you look at what the ABC does now compared to what it did at the start, you know, they've got to fund a 24-hour news channel, they fund a massive online news service now, their operations have had to expand, and they do have to produce all kinds of stuff with granted a budget I would kill for. So I think they have been disrupted, not as much as us. One thing I would say about the ABC, and again in the sort of vein of not very understood but quite important, in the Reuters survey that I mentioned during the conversation tonight, there's only one media property in Australia at the moment that lives outside the echo chamber. Just one. Can you guess? Got it. ABC TV. The only media property in the country at the moment that draws its audience equally from the left and the right is ABC television. Every other news property in the country, from the commercial TV free-to-air channels, who draw extensively from the right, Sky draws from the right, News draws from the right, Guardian draws from the left, Fairfax draws from the left, right? So you've got these sort of everybody off on these various points of the compass. Standing in the middle, holding this all together, is ABC television. So I'm all for having a go at the ABC when they don't do things well, and I would kill for their budget. I would absolutely kill for their budget. But that is a very, very special media property in this country at this time. It's a media property that can draw together an audience from across the spectrum. So I will defend it with my dying breath as an important strategic media property in this country at this time, in the middle of this disruption that we're talking about.
Catherine, many thanks.
My pleasure.
So, as I said, we've got copies of Catherine Murphy...